Good evening, everyone. We're very excited to have you here that are here for this, and we had a really good turnout this morning, and it was nice. We have these two different topics, and we have some diverse groups that have shown up for one or for the other, even for people within our church and without. But we're just very excited. I mean, we're a New Life Anglican Church, a church that likes to look at the difficult issues and the tough things that face us and think about how we should approach them as Christians. That we don't want to be people who only know just the words of the gospel and nothing else, but how, as gospel people, do we live in and engage this world? And so we're really thankful to have Alan to help us this morning with Islam and how we should relate to Islam. Last year he helped us with a couple issues, including dealing with evolution and intelligent design, and now tonight with abortion and stem cell research and cloning. So we're very happy to have Alan here. I won't go through his list of credentials, but we're very happy to have him here. And by the way, my name is Mike, and I'm the pastor here. I didn't introduce myself, but thank you. And Alan, whenever you're ready.
All right. Well, we have some somewhat serious content to talk about on Father's Day. A talk about abortion, right? I mean, what an ironic subject to discuss when, you know, of course, it's Father's Day. So, but I think, as Mike said, it's important that as people, we, as believers, as a body of believers, that we are thinking about these things and how to live as gospel-centered people in a world in which these things like abortion, stem cell research, and cloning are happening, and we have to be able to be prepared to deal with them. Now, you probably know that, at least in Christian circles, the term social justice is often talked a lot about. In fact, Christians are supposed to be heavily involved in social justice. And so this usually entails things like human trafficking, poverty, homelessness. And so these are all things that are important, no doubt. I'm not trying to downplay them. I think certainly as believers, we should be involved in trying to alleviate these kinds of social problems. What's odd is, though, sometimes abortion is left out of that list. And what's odd about that is if we believe that abortion is really what it is, and that is that it is the intentional killing of innocent human beings, then abortion becomes the most important social justice issue of our day. And one of the reasons is because abortion is still legal in all 50 states throughout all 9 months of pregnancy and for virtually any reason. And according to Planned Parenthood's own statistics, 3,500 unborn children are killed every single day just in the United States. Now, that's more than died on September 11th in one day, and yet this happens every single day. Now, that certainly is upsetting, but what upsets me even more is that according to people who have abortions, 28% of those people who are having these abortions identify themselves as Catholic. 37% of them identify themselves as Protestant. That means Christians are killing their own children. Turns out the most dangerous place then for an unborn child to be, or baby to be, is to be in her own mother's womb. And so I want to talk this evening about how we can make that place a safer place for children. And one of the things I want to talk about is specifically is how we can make abortion unthinkable in our spheres of influence, or if we're involved in any kind of if we have influence in a more leveraged way, then perhaps we can make abortion unthinkable in that way as well. Now, I know people are thinking, but wait a minute, Alan, come on. I mean, abortion is such a controversial issue. I mean, who can possibly change their mind? People are entrenched either pro-life or pro-choice, and people never change their mind. And I think this is absolutely false. In fact, I know it's false because I see people change their minds. And part of what we do at Stand to Reason is we equip believers to be able to use effective tactics that can help people change their minds on this issue. And so, again, I think the key is to understand just some important tactics that will help us be able to navigate some of these discussions. And so that's what I want to talk about. On your note sheet, there should be a list of three tasks. And I think these three tasks are probably the bare minimum that you would need to know in order to effectively change minds on abortion. And so I'll go through each one of them. The first one is to show there's really only one question to resolve in this abortion discussion. There's only one question. Now, when you start talking about abortion, you'll come to realize that people rarely talk about abortion. In fact, the instant you start talking about the subject at all, immediately the conversation will start to tangent off on some other issue. And people will end up talking about choice and privacy. They might start bringing up back alley abortions. They might start talking about unwantedness or financial hardship or the circumstances that many women face. And no doubt, these are real things. I'm not denying that these are issues. But the problem is that rarely is the issue of abortion itself talked about. Now, if you're the average person, you probably think to yourself, man, how can I possibly know everything there is to know about the statistics behind unwantedness or the financial hardship that maybe women face or, you know, rape and incest and what circumstances does that happen in? And you think, man, this is just overwhelming. I can't possibly know everything there is to know such that I can speak intelligently and persuasively on abortion. And the truth is, it's not the case that you have to know all of this stuff. In fact, there's really only one question to resolve. And that one question is, what is the unborn? And let me give you an illustration as to how I know this is the key question. Imagine one evening, you're just doing the dishes, and let's just pretend you have a 5-year-old, or let's say 7-year-old son. I have a 7-year-old son, so I know this kind of thing actually happens. But just pretend for a moment, you have a 7-year-old son, and while you're doing the dishes, your son comes up behind you, and while your back is turned to him, he asks you, Mommy or Daddy, says, can I kill this? Now, before you can answer his question, what question are you going to ask him? What is it? Yeah, right. So imagine you turn around, and he's holding a daddy long-legged spider in his hand. What's your answer going to be?
No.
if you pass for Mike, you're going to say, definitely kill it, right? Because he's got a fear of spiders. But the answer's like, sure, you can kill it. You grab one leg, I'll grab the other leg, and let's just pull, right? You know, split that sucker in two. But what if he's holding the neighbor's cat in his hand? What's your answer going to be?
No.
Well, it depends if you're a dog lover or not, right? I'm allergic to cats, so I'm like, yeah, punt that thing. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. No, the answer could be kind of, you might be more guarded in your answer. But what if he's holding his little sister by the neck? What's your answer going to be?
No.
No. Your kid needs counseling if he's coming around asking if he can kill this thing, which happens to be his sister. And so notice what this illustration shows, is that whether or not it's moral to kill something depends entirely upon what it is we're killing. Right? Can we kill it? The answer depends on what it is we're killing. And so here's the key point. If you ask the question, what is the unborn? And it turns out that the unborn is not a human being, then no justification for abortion is necessary. However, if you ask the question, what is the unborn? And it turns out the unborn is a human being, then no justification for abortion is adequate. Right? Think about that for a moment. If the unborn is not a human being, go ahead, have the abortion. What's the big deal? If it's just a part of the woman's body, like her appendix or her tonsils, yeah, go ahead, cut it up, take it out. Who cares? It's not a human. You don't have to give any arguments for why abortion should be permitted. Go ahead and have the abortion. But if it turns out that the unborn, through your analysis or whatever reasoning, that the unborn is a human being just like you and me, then there's no justification for killing an innocent human being like you and me, at least for the vast majority of reasons that women have abortions. And as you'll see in just a second, most defenses for abortion do not ask this question. They just simply assume that the unborn is not a human being. Now, what I want to do is show you, first of all, a tactic that'll help you to bring the conversation back to this one question, what is the unborn? Because although you might ask this question as being the key question, what happens in reality is that nobody wants to answer that, and they'll talk about everything else, rape and incest and choice and privacy and all these different things. And so I want to teach you a tactic. It's called trot out the toddler. And this is a tactic I use probably 10 times in every conversation I have with an abortion choice advocate. And in this particular tactic, what happens is it's almost functions like a funnel. So, you know, the conversation might, maybe you can't read those words because it's a small screen, but maybe the conversation's talking about unwantedness or choice or rape or privacy, and the person you're talking to is addressing all these other things, but not abortion and not the question of what is the unborn. This tactic functions like a funnel and allows you to take this wide variety of different subjects and bring the conversation back to this one question, what is the unborn, which is the key question and the question you want to stick to. Because otherwise, you'll spend days, or you'll spend hours, days, you know, weeks talking about everything else and never talking about abortion itself. And even if you were to convince somebody about your knowledge about abortion, or I'm sorry, about adoption or something else, it wouldn't matter. Because the issue is abortion, but that's the issue that's never talked about. So this is how the Trot Out the Toddler functions. Let me show you the three steps that are entailed in this thing, and then we'll look at some examples of how we can actually use it. So here's the three steps for this tactic. The first thing you want to do when you're in the conversation and it starts to tangent off the main issue of abortion is listen to their reason for abortion. Ask in your mind, what justification are they giving to say that abortion should be permissible? Okay. Once you have that in your mind and you understand their view, then you want to ask the key question. You ask, is it okay to kill a toddler for that same reason? Now, of course, their answer is going to be always no. Now, a toddler is like, let's say, a 2 or a 3-year-old, right? You're going to ask them, can I kill a 2 or 3-year-old for this, for the same reason that you just said we can have abortion? They're going to say no. They say, but that's different. The toddler is clearly a human being. The unborn is not. Ah, well, that's the key issue, isn't it? And so this will be allow you to have a chance to clarify then the real issue isn't the rationale they've given. The key issue is, what is the unborn? Now, this might sound a little vague, but so we're going to give some, go through a number of examples to show you what this looks like in real conversation. So let's try it with one of the most common defenses for abortion. And again, I'm just taking a snippet out of a conversation. Obviously, this is a long, drawn-out conversation, but I'm just kind of capturing a snippet to kind of get at the issue. So you're having a talk. You're trying to make your case for the pro-life view. And instead of talking about abortion, you're now on some other subject matter, namely that women should have the right to privacy. This is what was part of the rationale behind Roe versus Wade. And so you want to bring the conversation back to the key question, what is the unborn? And so what do you do? First step of Trot Out the Toddler tactic is what? Listen to the reason for, right. So what's the justification that's being offered here for abortion? That's right, the right to privacy. They're saying women should have the freedom to have an abortion because they have a right to privacy. Okay, so the right to privacy is their justification. Now let's use the second step. The second step is, let's ask a question if it's justified to kill a toddler for that reason. Okay, so let's ask the question. How about this? Do we allow a mother to kill her 2-year-old son if she does it in the privacy of her own home? Now, what's the answer going to be from any normal human being on the planet? No, of course not. Why not? Why can't you kill a child as long as you do it in the privacy of your own home? What's that? Yeah, it's a human being, exactly. So we all agree that the 2-year-old toddler is a human being, but what does the abortion choice advocate not believe about the unborn?
That they're alive.
Yeah, that they're alive or a human being like the 2-year-old or 3-year-old toddler. And so this is what they'll complain about. So, wait a minute, this is different. A 2 or a 3-year-old is obviously a human being. The unborn is not. You say, oh, okay, so that's the key question. Is the unborn like the 2 or 3-year-old? Is it a human being like this toddler? And so that's when you can then clarify. The real issue isn't privacy. Privacy isn't the issue that justifies killing a human being or not. The issue is whether they're a human or not. Let's try it again. Women should have the freedom to choose. Okay, first step. What's their justification for abortion?
Right to choose.
Yeah, right to choose. Well, you can't give all the answers because you've I know.
The only literate person.
Yeah, that's right. their justification is women should have the freedom to choose. So what would be an example of a Trot Out the Toddler question? Let's use the same justification to suggest if it's okay to kill a born human being for this. Yeah?
Didn't she have the freedom to choose before the child was conceived?
Well, yes, that's true. But that's a whole other question, right? I mean, you're right. Of course, she has the freedom to choose to not engage in sexual intercourse, which is the only way you can get pregnant these days. Well, I take that back. There are new ways to get pregnant, but yeah. But sticking to the Trot Out the Toddler tactic, what would be a Trot Out the Toddler question that would use this justification
is
go ahead.
Is it okay to choose to kill a 2-year-old?
That's right. Is it okay? Do you think women should have their freedom to choose to kill their two-year-old toddlers? Now, the answer is obviously no. But the reason why the abortion choice advocate will have a problem with this question is they'll say, yeah, of course you can't kill born human beings, but the unborn aren't human beings. But see, then this is then the really issue, the issue isn't choice. The issue is the unborn a human being just like the two-year-old? If the unborn is a human being just like the two-year-old or just like all of us, then you can't kill the unborn for the reason of choice, for the same reason you can't kill a two-year-old for the reason of choice. So clearly, choice is not the issue. The real issue is, what is the unborn? You see how we're now back to the key question, what is the unborn? Because you don't want to go off and talking about choice and, you know, what rights we have as human. You know, you'll talk about that forever, and you'll never talk about abortion. Many poor women can't afford another child, so therefore abortion should be illegal. What's the reason that they're offering for abortion?
Financial.
Yeah, financial. Financial hardship. Okay, what kind of trot out the toddler question could you ask to show that this is not really the issue? Yes?
Can you kill your two-year-old toddler just because you can't afford that child?
That's right. Can you kill a two-year-old toddler just because you can't afford them, right? You know, I got a couple of kids, and they go through cereal bowls, you know, like crazy, right? And in like 2 days, they finish the cereal bowl. I mean, this is expensive stuff. Cereal's like, sometimes like $4 a box of cereal for any kind of healthy cereal. That's expensive. Do we have the right to kill them because they're too hard on our budget? And of course, the abortion choice advocate will say, absolutely not. I'll say, well, then really, the financial hardship isn't a justification to kill a human being. And they'll say, that's correct, it's not. They'll say, then why should we be able to kill the unborn for financial hardship? And they'll say, because the unborn's not a human being. And you'll say, okay, then that's the question. Is the unborn a human being? I think it is. You don't think it is. So that's what we should be talking about. Is the unborn a human being? Do you see how we're always coming back to what is the unborn? How about this one? An unwanted child should not be forced to come into the world. What's the justification being offered here? Unwantedness. That's right. Yeah, some children are unwanted. Okay, so what's a good trot of the toddler question that would use that same justification to justify killing a toddler?
Should any unwanted child be killed?
That's right. That's right. Is it permissible to kill your three-year-old daughter if you no longer want her? And what is the abortion choice advocate going to say?
No.
But I thought you said that an unwanted child should not be forced in the world. Isn't unwantedness justification to kill a human being? They'll say no, but the unborn's what? Not a human being. Oh, okay, well, that's what I think she is. You don't think she is. So let's talk about that question. Is the unborn a human being? What is the unborn? Do you see how I'm not allowing anyone to start talking about choice or unwantedness or financial hardship? And the reason is because I've done this for too long, and no, it'll go nowhere. You'll talk about everything except for abortion. And so, I mean, you know, hours will go by, you'll part ways, and you'll say, man, no one ever changes their mind on abortion. That's right, because you were never talking about it. I'm not trying to be critical of you here. I'm just saying that this is what happens. Even when we train people in this and they don't follow this, they end up talking about all these other issues, and then they complain, no one changes their mind. That's because you weren't talking about it. You're talking about unwantedness for a half an hour, and then you started talking about, you know, adoption rates. I mean, these are all interesting, but they don't focus on the key issue. A child with Down syndrome, or you name the condition or disease, shouldn't have to suffer. Okay, what is the justification that's being offered in this case for abortion?
A genetic defect.
Yeah, genetic defect. You know, in this case, Down syndrome, which is trisomy 21, but it could be anything, right? A child, you know, has X condition, and we don't want them to suffer. They say, so okay. How could you trot up the toddler with this particular issue? How would you, you know, they want to talk about the suffering of children and the suffering of people. How would we bring the conversation back to what is the unborn? What's the question we would ask?
If the toddler came down with some disease.
Yeah. Yeah, if a three-year-old, sure, or if you had a three-year-old with Down syndrome. Or if you had a three-year-old with hemophilia, you know, they can't, their blood can't clot. Or you name the condition. Do we allow, is it permissible then to kill the three-year-old girl just because they have Down syndrome? And again, you notice I'm belaboring this point for a reason, by the way. You're right, thinking, okay, Alan, we get it. But you might get it, but I need you to really, really get it because this is so critical. So, of course, they're going to say, no, you can't kill a three-year-old child just because they have Down syndrome. Okay, well, then Down syndrome isn't a justification to kill the unborn either. Let's say, but the unborn's not a human being. Exactly. You don't think they are. We think they are. So let's talk about, is the unborn a human being just like this three-year-old? Yeah, did you have a question?
I'd just like to make a comment. This sure. Last example, in my view, is a little more murky or complex because there are those people who believe in euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, and the rationale is compassion and he's suffering, etc.
Yeah, I suppose it could be, but most people don't believe it's permissible to kill children with these conditions. But you're right. At the end of life, there is a greater sense in which we would say the compassionate thing to do would be to terminate the person's life. Although technically the term compassion means to suffer with. It doesn't mean to end suffering, but that's a whole other issue. Maybe next year we'll talk about euthanasia and the ethics of life and death. But no, you're right. I understand what you're saying. But for the most part, even abortion choice advocates don't think it's permissible to kill three-year-old children just because they have Down syndrome or any condition. And so you're using this as a way to illustrate that they're just assuming the unborn is not a human being. Of course, you're assuming that it is. And now I'm not making the case that the unborn is a human being just yet, I will. But for now, you're just trying to bring the question or the issue or the conversation back to the key question, what is the unborn? Otherwise, you'll spend forever talking about everything else. Okay, how about this one? Women shouldn't have to carry a child conceived through rape. And in virtually every conversation I've had, every debate I've had, every secular university I've presented, this is the key issue that everybody brings up because they consider it to be one of the hard cases. And it is a hard case, but we can answer this as well. Now, before I answer this using the Trot of the Toddler question, I want to point out something. I want to show you actually a quick video clip of a college campus that we were on where a woman who had expressed that she had been raped and she had gotten pregnant. And then we had a bunch of pro-lifers who had kind of surrounded her and were kind of pestering her about the pro-life issue. And I just want you to watch this short video clip of this conversation unfold. And you might say, well, you know, what's going on in the video? You'll see, but nothing significant happens, but I want to make a comment about the video afterwards. So take a look at what goes on.
I'm sure you do. Maybe you would feel worse if I was screaming in childbirth, if I was a mother who never had the ability to go to college, if I was homeless with this kid and no money, no way of supporting it. Maybe if I was in a more hopeless situation, you could actually see and understand that I made the choice for a reason. I shouldn't have to hit rock bottom for someone else to say, oh, well, I guess the other choice was better.
But you see that you're basing the whole argument on the fact that you were 13 and that you were raped and you got pregnant.
Yes, I'm basing the argument on the exception to the rule.
Right.
There is an exception to the rule, which means you cannot say abortion is illegal because someone's going to need that. Someone's going to have that in their lives to make their lives worth living.
So what about abortion in the cases of not being raped, a woman who's 22.
Again, she's making that choice for a reason. She has that reasoning ability within her.
This conversation went on for probably 45 minutes, where about 5 or 6 different pro-lifers were surrounding her and going on about this issue. And never once did any pro-lifer stop and say to her, I am so sorry that you were raped and that this has happened to you. You know, was the person who did this to you brought to justice? What, you know, I am so sorry that you have been violated in a way that is perhaps the most significant possible way that you could be violated. And many times when the issue of rape comes up, it isn't a test to see if the pro-lifer has a logical response. It's a test to see if the pro-lifer has a heart. Because many times we come across as these robotic people who are just answering the question of abortion in a logical way. And we're forgetting the fact that we're standing in front of a person who has been assaulted and violated in a significant way. And it's no wonder people say, Well, you pro-lifers, all you care about is babies, but you don't care about the women who are carrying them, you know? And again, I'm not saying that, I'm not claiming that rape justifies abortion. I'm simply saying that we have to sometimes, especially when this issue comes up, stop for a moment and acknowledge what is going on. Because many times, or I want to say many times, but it's certainly possible that if a woman is making this complaint, that she's making the complaint perhaps because this happened to her. Now, obviously, if it's a guy, that's probably not the issue. But nevertheless, people want to see that we actually care about human beings, all human beings. And so I would just caution you that if this subject comes up, to acknowledge, at least initially, the evil of rape before you kind of move on and provide sort of your logical, rational response. Even though we have plenty of solid, you know, rational and logical thinking to kind of respond to it, be sure, though, to show that you have a heart and you recognize what's going on. So I just kind of make that as a comment before we move forward. Yes, ma'am.
I appreciate that, by the way. However, let's say you show that compassion, and that woman turned around and said, based on your logic, the toddler trot thing, you're basically calling me a murderer. I mean, what do you do when someone throws that bag at you, based on your logic?
You mean, well, you mean if you make the case that yes. Abortion in the instance of rape is still killing a human being?
Or any of these other things, you know, I mean, in essence, we're calling those people by that, you know, the M word, if you will.
The M word? Yeah, I mean, well, certainly, yeah. Yes, that's precisely why we're opposed to abortion, because it's the intentional killing of an innocent human being. Now, you know, murder carries it with a connotation usually that's associated with knowing that there is a human being and we're killing that person. And many times, I truly believe a lot of women don't necessarily think that it is a child because they've been told otherwise, even by professionals. So, you know, it's not that I'm avoiding the term murder, but I just would say, yeah, you're killing an innocent human being, and it's wrong to do so. I mean, that's the way I would capture it. So, if she says, are you calling me somebody who's killed a human being, my own child? And I wouldn't shrink back from that. But with regards to the issue of rape, I'd first make sure that they understood that I wasn't just simply trying to say that without acknowledging something about what's happened to this person. Now, so make sure you kind of acknowledge that before you kind of move forward. But again, I think you can, again, trot out the toddler in this situation as well, right? Because what's the justification that's been offered for abortion in this example? A woman should be able to have an abortion in this example because what? She's been raped. That's right. So they're using rape as a justification for abortion. Okay. Trot out the toddler. What question could you ask that uses that same justification to justify killing a toddler?
If this child's a product of rape, then I should be able to kill it.
That's right. Can a mother kill her two-year-old child? If we had a child right here, let's say my daughter was here. I have a five-year-old daughter. If my daughter was conceived through rape, could my wife kill my daughter because she was conceived through rape? What's the answer? No. Why not? You're killing an innocent human being. But this child will remind me of that rape maybe my whole life. Is that true? Possibly. Well, does that justify killing this four-year-old, five-year-old? No. Because we don't kill human beings, innocent human beings, simply because they remind us of a traumatic incident. Of course, now the abortion choice advocate will say, but that's different. Your five-year-old daughter is clearly a human being. The unborn is not a human... Oh, okay. See, here we go again. You're assuming the unborn's not a human being, and I'm assuming that they are. So that's the real question. The issue is not rape, because rape doesn't justify killing innocent human beings. And if the unborn is a human being, just like my five-year-old daughter, then we can't kill this unborn child for the same reason we can't kill the five-year-old. Does that make sense? Trot out the toddler tactic works in virtually every circumstance, because what's happening is the other person is assuming, not proving, assuming that the unborn is not a human being. And so again, we're trying to make sure that that's not an assumption that's just left unchecked, but rather we want to make that explicit so we can talk about it and then try to answer the question. Now, just because rape is a difficult issue, let me give you another kind of perspective as to why abortion in the case of rape does not make any sense. Imagine for a moment that a woman is raped, she does get pregnant, and they eventually catch the rapist. Okay? Do we in our culture allow the mother to shoot and kill the rapist if he's caught? No. Some of us probably say we should allow that, right? But we don't, right? Because we think that's not just. Well, okay. So if the mother can't shoot and kill the rapist who is guilty, why should she be allowed to kill the child who is innocent? Right? Why should the child pay for the crime of his father? It makes no sense. If anyone should be killed, it should be the guilty party, not the innocent one. But when we allow for abortion in the instance of rape, we are saying we can go ahead, after us being victimized, we can now turn around and victimize another completely innocent person. That makes no sense. I'm not saying we should kill rapists, but if anybody deserves to die, it's the guilty party, not the innocent one. And that's why, you know, although as persuasive as people might sound when they're talking about the issue of rape, and I get that, I understand. I've been across, you know, abortion choice advocates in a debate situation and in audience situations where they've made this case. But when you think about it, it doesn't make any sense. So again, the point though being is that we're just using this tactic, trot at the toddler, to bring the conversation back to the one question, what is the unborn? And I, of course, I brought up the question, can you victimize an innocent human being simply because you've been victimized yourself? And the answer is of course not. You know, if somebody drives their car and loses control and smashes their car into your living room, do you have the right to then turn around and take your car and smash into someone else's living room? Somebody who's completely innocent of that crime? No, it makes no sense. If justice is to be served, it's the person who committed the crime, not some other innocent human being. Okay, any questions about trot out the toddler before we move to the next task of answering the question, what is the unborn? I showed you a lot of examples because I want to really drive home this point, only because I've seen for years how many people just go off on the tangents and follow the conversation of an abortion choice advocate to no avail, because they're never talking about abortion, they're talking about something else. And the key question is what? Is the unborn a human being? That's right. What is the unborn? Yes?
I just read recently, and I can't bring up in my mind where, maybe on the internet or something, that there's another thought emerging that a newborn is not a human.
Yes. This is actually fairly an old idea that newborns even are allowed to be killed because they're not persons. We'll talk about this in a minute, but yeah, there's a guy named Peter Singer who's at Princeton University. He's a well-known bioethics philosopher, actually world known. He wrote the definitive book on animal rights, and he argues that even newborn infants, it's permissible to kill them for up to 4 weeks if they have some sort of a disability, if it brings more happiness to the parents to kill that child and then have another child that doesn't have the disability. That is, I've read all of his works. I know this is not an out of context or an exaggeration of his view. This is his view.
Or they kill girls because they want
a boy. Well, yeah, I don't know if he makes that case. I don't know if he's argued for gender side per se, but certainly that's permissible in other cases, yeah. So even newborns are kind of not... And we'll talk about why they make that case. Yes?
It seems like the one that you hear more often than any other on the floor of Congress from politicians is for the woman's health issue.
Yeah.
And you really haven't...
Yeah, I haven't addressed that.
Use that as an example.
Sure. I'm trying to think if I should tell you the answer to that now or in the next section.
Okay.
Let's see that. Ask me after the next session. Okay, after next task. Okay?
Okay,
yeah. But I do want to answer that because that's an interesting moral dilemma. I don't think it's actually the case of it's not an example of elective abortion in the true sense of the word. It's actually we're facing a moral dilemma in that instance. But we'll talk about that in just a minute. Any other questions though, about trot out the toddler? Okay. So let's just say then that they've accepted that this is the key question. Oh, okay, You smart aleck Christian, you think, okay, what is the unborn? Fine. They want to accept that. Yeah, well, okay, prove to me the unborn is a human being. So let's just say they kind of accept that. Now your second task is to show that the unborn is a human being. Now, the good news about this is that we have clear evidence from science and both philosophy, specifically the science of embryology, that the unborn is a human being from the moment of conception. And I'll show, there's three parts to this. One, to show that the unborn is a living being, that it's alive. Show that the unborn is a distinct individual, meaning it's not part of the mother's body. It's a unique individual separate from the mother. And the third thing is that it's a human type of being. And I believe the science of embryology speaks decisively on this question. There's really no room for any alternative to this. In fact, a few years ago, I was speaking at Central Michigan University. I guess it's, I don't know, a couple hours south of here. And I was invited by the Pro-Life Club there to present the pro-life position to the university audience and then debate anybody in the audience who wants to challenge my views. And one of the things that the biology professors of that university said is, oh, there's some pro-lifer coming who's going to try to argue science. I will offer extra credit to anybody who can debunk Mr. Schliemann's scientific evidence. So, of course, they came, and it's not because I'm anything special. The fact of the matter is that the science is so decisive, nobody was able to present any legitimate objections that were able to be sustained. And you'll see why that's the case, because the evidence is rather compelling in our favor, at least in the pro-life view's favor. So let's take a look at the first one. What evidence is there that the unborn is a living being? Well, this is probably the least controversial. There's really no period of non-life anywhere in the continuum. Right? You have two gametes, the sperm and the egg. These are both alive. They're both living cells. They come together to fuse and form a zygote, which is the first stage of human development. And that zygote is also alive, and it starts to grow. So there's no period of non-life anywhere in the process. Also, the unborn is growing, and things that grow tend to be alive. Okay? So that's certainly good evidence that the unborn is a living thing. In fact, if you think about it, all the unborn needs to grow are the same things that you and I need to survive, right? If you give the unborn nutrition and proper environment, the unborn will grow just fine, just like we will too. We can't survive without nutrition and proper environment. The unborn can't survive without nutrition and proper environment. There's no difference. And the third thing is that from a biological perspective, the unborn meets the biological criteria for life. In other words, you know, crystals grow in nature, but crystals don't have these criteria, and that is that a living thing, to be considered living in the scientific realm, you have to be able to metabolize nutrients and convert it into energy, you need to be able to grow, and you need to be able to respond to stimuli. If you do those three things, then you are considered to be a living thing. So grow, respond to stimuli, and metabolize nutrients and convert it into energy. That's what constitutes biological life. The unborn does all three things. Therefore, the unborn, even from the moment of conception, is a living thing. No question about that. Now, the question is, well, wait a minute. Okay, yeah, it's a living thing, but isn't it just part of the mother's body, like her appendix or her tonsils or her molars or something like that? And again, I think the answer is given from the science of embryology, and it's decisive on this question. In fact, there are a number of things about the unborn that are different than the mother. Does anybody have any ideas of some things that might be different about the unborn and the mother that would be evidence that they are two unique individual beings?
Gender.
Yes, that's true. The unborn could be a different gender than the mother. It could be a boy. In fact, there's a story of my boss, who also teaches on this. He was one time at a party in Hollywood, and he was talking to this woman who was an animal rights activist, and she was pregnant. And she says, well, you know, I respect all of life, and so that's why I believe we should protect animals. And he said, oh, well, you must be pro-life as well. She said, well, no, actually, I'm not. You know, and he said, oh, I'm curious. Why is that? She says, well, you know, my body, my choice, she said. Which is this notion that it's my body, the unborn is just a part of my body, so therefore I have the right to choose to do whatever I want to my own body. Now, of course, he wanted to kind of disabuse her of this notion, so he said, can I ask you a personal question? And she said, sure, of course, go ahead. He said, do you have a penis? She's like, well, no, of course I don't. He said, could your unborn child have a penis? And she said, well, yeah. He said, well, then your unborn child is not part of your body. And now, I don't recommend you try this at every party you go to. But nevertheless, it was convincing to her. And she's like, oh, yeah, good point, you know. Right? If her unborn, if the unborn is just simply a part of her body, then she could, as you will, have a different two genders. She could have four arms, you know, four legs, two brains. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense. So, yeah, absolutely, gender is one example. What else? What other things are different about the unborn and the mother? Yes?
DNA.
The DNA, absolutely. I mean, think of forensic science. When we, you know, investigators come to a crime scene and they pick up samples, they use DNA to distinguish each person individually who's distinct from everybody else. And if you look at the DNA of the unborn, it's clearly a unique individual being that is different than the DNA of the mother. And so that is decisive. There's no question about it. We're talking about two human beings. Good. What else?
Blood type,
that's right. The unborn could have a separate blood type than the mother. It's not necessary, but it certainly is possible that the unborn has a different blood type. In fact, the unborn has a separate circulatory system altogether. You know what's interesting about this is that the blood of the unborn comes very close to the blood of the mother in the placenta. Thank you. The name escaped me for a second. In the placenta. So the unborn's blood, unborn child's blood, and the mother's blood comes very, very close, so that there can be exchange of nutrients and waste. But the blood never mixes between the mother and the child. Now, what's interesting is if there was some sort of a defect or a mistake where the blood was to start to mix, guess what would happen? The mother's body would mount an immune response against the unborn child. Why? Because the mother's body perceives the unborn to be a foreign entity, a foreign body. If the unborn was just part of her body, like her appendix, then her immune system wouldn't attack it, because it recognizes her own body. But the fact is that the mother's body knows this is a complete, unique individual that doesn't kind of belong here, if you will. Which again is further evidence that the unborn is a unique individual, not part of her body. Otherwise, why would the immune response be that way? Good. Anything else in terms of the differences between the mother and the child?
Maybe he has a heart that
beats. That's right. Yes, the unborn has a separate heart and heartbeat. In fact, at 3 weeks gestation, you have the unborn having a different heart and heartbeat. The fingerprints of the unborn are unique and different. The DNA, we already mentioned the DNA. Different circulatory system and blood type. This is at about, about 3 weeks you have a blood going and a heart pumping. Oh, a separate brain and brainwave pattern. At about 6 weeks you have the primitive brain developing. Different gender, you mentioned that. Here's another thing. The unborn can be conceived outside of the mother's body in a petri dish and then later implanted inside a mother. Which is further evidence that the unborn is not part of her body. You can make a human being apart from her body and then later put it in. It's again, further evidence that it's not the same. In fact, you can have a Chinese child growing inside a Swedish mother. I mean, how much more of a visual could you have that demonstrates that we're talking about two different individual beings, right? So again, there's just so much evidence just from observation, common sense, and the science of embryology that shows we're talking about two unique individuals. So we've established that the unborn is a living being, and we've established that the unborn is a separate, unique individual distinct from the mother. Now the question is this distinct individual being a dog being? Is it a chicken being? Is it a Venus flytrap being? What kind of biological species is it? And there's there are basically two main ways that you can figure this out. And the first is simply looking at the genetic fingerprints, if you will, signature of the unborn. So for example, you can't see this very well, and it's a little bit small, but if you were to take four embryos, and that's what those four gray things are, of four different species, and initially, you can't really tell which one's which, you know, which is a dog or a cat or a human. But if you were to look at the DNA, you would be able to decisively determine whether one is a fish in one case, perhaps a bird in another, a turtle in another, and then a human in another, just by looking at the DNA genetic signature. It would be decisive. In biology, they call this discipline called taxonomy. And taxonomy just simply says that everything that's alive, plant or animal, has some sort of biological address. And in the case of looking at different species, we can know definitively that the unborn is a human being just by looking at its taxonomical address. But there's a much easier way to figure this out, and this is something that Louis Pasteur developed back in the 19th century. He helped develop this idea known as biogenesis. And this is the notion that living things reproduce after their own kind. So for example, if you have two dogs that get together and mate, they're going to produce another what? Dog. If you have two tigers that mate, and they're going to produce another what?
Tiger.
That's right. When my wife and I were pregnant, we may have wondered whether we're going to have a boy or a girl, but it's not like we wondered whether we're going to have a human or not. Right? And it was just like it was obvious, right? Because we're both humans. We're going to have a human. In fact, when we had our second child, my wife was pregnant with her second child, and we had that second child, we weren't surprised. We're like, oh, wow, look, two humans in a row. What are the chances, you know? That wasn't a surprise for us because we know that living things reproduce after their own kind. So this gives us a very handy and practical test. If you want to know what kind of being the unborn is, just simply ask a question. What are its parents? And if its parents are humans, there is no scientifically possible way that its offspring will not be human as well. It's just plain biogenesis. There's no possible, you can't say that two humans can get together and mate and produce some living thing that is not human, but then later becomes one. This is just completely contrary to all reasoning and, of course, all science as well. So let's take a look. I'm going to show you a video of the unborn in what's called called an embryoscopy. It's not an ultrasound. It's actually where they take a camera inside of the side of the mother and inside the amniotic sac and actually look at the unborn child floating around in the amniotic sac. It's phenomenal. And so there's a quick video that shows kind of what this unborn human being looks like. And again, it's not the case that just because it looks human, it makes it human. But still, there's something about the fact that when we see this, it certainly evokes in us a certain kinship. Is it 9 weeks old? So, you know, before this started, you notice it said, let the unborn testify on their own behalf. You know, in every kind of a court case, you always let the defendant, in a sense, kind of testify on their behalf, and that's kind of what we're doing. We're saying, look, visually speaking, let them say, hey, look, I'm a human being. You know, you could see, you know, he or she has hands, and, you know, they're floating around, kind of just around their umbilical cord, you know, just kind of hanging out there. So it's really remarkable that even at 9 weeks, you have this person that looks rather human to us. And so, again, from the science of embryology simply, we've shown that the unborn is three things. It's alive, it's a unique individual, and it's a human type of being. And we've shown all of this not looking at Genesis or Psalms or any part of the Bible. We're just looking at basic evidence from science of embryology. And it's not that I don't think the Bible speaks to this. It does, but you'll probably realize that if you're talking to people who don't accept the Bible as an authority, you want to be able to use sources of reasoning and of evidence that don't appeal to the Bible so that you're not dismissed. You know, and of course, they can't dismiss what they consider to be a credible source of authority, and that is, you know, science. So again, even from a scientific perspective, we have all of these things, that the unborn is alive, distinct from its mother, and a human, all happening from the moment of conception. This is the case. In fact, what's odd is that there's many embryologists and scientists who readily accept this. In fact, this is a college textbook by Moore and Prasad called Essentials of Embryology. It's a standard embryology textbook that's used in universities. And here they're saying the zygote, which is the first stage of human development, formed by the union of an oocyte and sperm, of an egg and a sperm, is the beginning of a new human being. That's pretty clear. O'Reilly and Mueller say this: although life is a continual process, this is their embryology textbook, although life is a continuous process, fertilization is a critical landmark because under ordinary circumstances, a new, genetically distinct human organism is formed when the chromosomes of the male and female pronuclei blend in the oocyte. And then David Boonen, who's perhaps the top abortion choice philosopher in our country, he teaches out in Colorado, acknowledges, he says at the bottom there, says a human fetus, after all, is simply a human being at a very, very early stage in his or her development. And even the notorious Peter Singer, probably one of the most vocal and dangerous philosophers in our world today, philosopher at Princeton University, he used to chair the Department of Philosophy there, says there is no doubt that from the first moments of his existence, an embryo conceived from human sperm and egg is a human being. So again, you have all these people making this case. Now, how many here know who Kathy Ireland is? She was a movie star. What's that? Well, she was also a model. Yeah, she was a swimsuit model on the cover of like Sports Illustrated and did all kinds of stuff. But she's actually also a pro-life Christian now. And many years ago, she came to us at Stand to Reason and said, hey, you know what? I'm going to be going on a TV show called, what's the name of the show? It's the, on Fox News, left and right guys, Sean Hannity and, Hannity and Combs. Jeez, I don't know why I forgot. So there used to be a show called Hannity and Combs. Has anyone heard of this show? So it's a conservative, liberal kind of talk show, political talk show. And she was going to go on national television on this show to talk about a new book that she wrote. And in that book, she talks about her pro-life view. And one of the things that she wanted to do was kind of, you know, get her pro-life debating skills up in check. So she came to us, and we trained her in the very exact same stuff that I just taught you. And then she went on the show, and I want to show you a video clip of her being on the show and kind of using this material in a hostile setting. So let's take a look and see how she did.
Joining us now, Kathy Ireland, author of the new book, Powerful Inspirations, 8 Lessons That'll Change Your Life. Kathy, welcome to Hannity & Combs. What do you think about doing a political show like this?
Oh, I think it's great. I love you guys. Thank you for having me.
Did you watch our show?
It's great. I do.
Gee, I wonder which side you agree with. Now, I'm guessing you're pretty conservative, but you were telling me off the air you have a very strong liberal position.
You know, I don't like labels. They cause us to dismiss one another, assuming we know all there is to know. I'm conservative on some issues, and I'm liberal on some issues. I'm very liberal when it comes to protecting the human rights of the unborn.
All right, now, I'm very conservative,
Kathy,
and I feel the government has no place in having anything to say about what women do with their bodies concerning that. So I've got a conservative position on that.
Is it her body? I didn't want to be pro-choice. But when you ask powerful questions, you get powerful answers. That's one of the chapters in the book, Powerful Answers.
Right.
And the evidence I see tells me that the unborn is a human being. If you can show me any evidence that the unborn is not a human being...
Yes, but when has it become? We're not going to settle this here tonight, I don't think. But, I mean, is it a conception? Is that when it happens?
At the moment of conception, a new life comes into being with the complete genetic blueprints, the fingerprint is determined, the blood type is determined, the sex is determined.
So
what kind of life
going,
is it? According to the law of biogenesis.
You would deny women the right to then choose what to do at that point.
I will always fight for women's rights. I have been an activist for women's rights, and I will continue to
be. But she doesn't have the right to choose what to do with her body.
It's not her body. The baby this woman is carrying could very well have a different blood type than her. If it's a male child, the baby has a penis. The woman doesn't have a penis, so it's not a part of her body, but it resides within her body.
I don't want to dwell just on this issue. People are not going to come to agreement on this all of a sudden. It's a very divisive issue.
And I'm sad that it's
however, let me ask you.
He's no longer on that show.
Oh, is he not? Oh, yeah. Maybe because of that. So there you have her. You notice she used, a lot of the elements we talked about, biogenesis, fingerprint, and she was focusing on what? The key issue, right? And that is what question? What is the unborn? It's a human being. And she's showing from this science of embryology why it's the case. She even gave the penis example. It's like on national television, right? So it's just like, okay, great. But she did it, right? Now, keep in mind, this is a hostile setting. It's on national television. It's very fast-paced, and that's kind of necessary to kind of make good TV. But, you know, your average conversation isn't going to be like this, obviously. Some might, but they're not always going to be like this. But it's interesting that, you know, she made her case and she, you know, there's nothing that Alan Combs said that sort of refuted her view, but she's still able to make the case and kind of leave it at that. So, but again, same material that you guys know, just applied in this particular situation. But I just want you to see that it's effective in being able to be used in kind of any sort of situation. So any questions then about the second task? First task was we want to show there's only one question to resolve, and the second task is to show that the unborn is a human being. Any questions about that particular point? Anything that you thought was weak or whatever? Okay, well, let's go to the third task then. And the third task is to show that all human beings are valuable, okay? Not just the ones that are born, but all human beings. And so we've shown that the unborn is a human being, but here's what happens. This is the moral logic of our view. There's two premises. This is the first two sentences. We say, look, it's wrong to kill innocent human beings, and we say it's abortion kills an innocent human being. So if those first two sentences are true, then the conclusion logically follows. It's a valid deductive argument. Therefore, abortion is wrong, right? If it's wrong to kill innocent human beings and abortion kills an innocent human being, then abortion's wrong. That's all we're saying. Now, here's how the vast majority of philosophers and debate opponents have tried to change this. They say this. It's not wrong to kill innocent human beings. They say it's wrong to kill innocent human persons. And abortion kills an innocent human being, but it doesn't kill a person. Therefore, abortion is not wrong. So this is how they change kind of our view. They're basically saying it might be a human being, but it's not a person. In fact, I debated a feminist, women's studies feminist professor at Cal State University in San Marcos a few years ago. I think it was 2 years ago. And this was the move that she took. So I presented the scientific case that the unborn is a human being from the moment of conception, and she, by necessity, had to acknowledge and say, okay, I will accept that. I'll accept the science that Alan's presenting. But then she said, but, you know, and then she tried to argue that not all human beings are worthy of protection. And those human beings that are not are the ones that are not persons. Now, if anyone ever makes this claim, there's an obvious question that comes to mind. Does anybody know what that question is?
Germany.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I'll come to that. You're right, in a moment. But when somebody says the unborn might be a human, but it's not a person, what question pops into your mind? What's the difference? Right? What you've just, and they have to have an answer to this question, right? Because they've just made the incredible claim that there are a group of human beings out there that can be killed with impunity simply because they're not persons. Okay, well, which ones are they? Which humans are they so we can go out and kill them because, you know, they're not... I mean, this is an incredible claim. Now, here's how every abortion choice advocate I've run into or read and that I think exists in the world answers this question. They usually point to certain characteristics or qualities that they think makes a human being a person. And any quality or characteristic they cite is going to be in one of these four categories. It's going to be either something to do with their size or physical appearance, their level of development, something about the environment, or their degree of dependency. And you can remember these four categories by the acronym SLED. And this is what we call the SLED test. It's another tactic that we use in conversation with people who are abortion choice advocates. So what we're saying basically is this. Yes, it's true, the unborn is different than a born human being in size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. But, as I'm about to show, none of those four categories is relevant to disqualifying some human beings from being a person. Okay, and we'll look at some examples of that. So, they might say, well, the unborn is so small, and by the way, when we talk about stem cell research and cloning in the next session here, you'll see this all pop up as well. But so let's take each one of these in turn. Size. Some people say, oh, look, the unborn is so small, you know, it can't be a human being. Well, yes, I agree. The unborn is smaller than a born human being. But why does size have anything to do with how valuable you are? Or how does size make you into a person? I mean, here is a picture of Shaquille O'Neal with a young lady. I mean, clearly, you know, men are generally larger than women. Does that mean men are more valuable than women? Men, don't answer that question. Just, I'm asking them. There's always a guy like, yeah, yeah, like, sir, you're not helping, you know. No, of course not, right? Because size is irrelevant, you know? Is Shaquille O'Neal more of a person than Hillary Clinton? I mean because he's larger, is he? Yeah. No, just kidding. Yeah, that's right. It has nothing to do with it, yeah. Yeah, he might be a better basketball player or something, but his size is irrelevant to whether he's a person or not, or whether he's valuable or not, you know? My 5-year-old daughter is smaller than me. Is she less of a person or less valuable simply because she's smaller? The answer is obviously no. So size has nothing to do with whether you're a person or not, or whether you're valuable or not. Let's take the next one, L, level of development. That's a picture of my son when he was just a couple weeks born, by the way. Yes, it's true that unborn human beings are less developed than born human beings. But why does level of development somehow disqualify you from being a valuable person? I mean, my 5-year-old daughter isn't even fully developed enough to reproduce. She can't bear children. And yet a 15-year-old girl does have the development of being able to reproduce. Does that mean that a 15-year-old girl is more valuable than my 5-year-old daughter? Or that a 15-year-old girl is more of a person than my 5-year-old daughter? No, of course not. It's irrelevant. So again, all appeals to the development of the unborn are irrelevant when it comes to disqualifying them from personhood, because that is an irrelevant characteristic. The environment, the E in SLED. Yes, it's true that the unborn is located in a different location than a born human being. But as Francis Beckwith says, where one is has no bearing on who one is, right? I mean, there's some people who float out in space in a spacesuit. I mean, they've certainly changed location. Does the fact that they're in a different location somehow affect their value or their qualities as a person? You know, when you swim underwater, does that change how you are as a person or as a valuable being? No, of course not, because where you are has no bearing on your value. It doesn't disqualify you from being a person simply because you change locations. And then finally, the D stands for degree of dependency. You know, and many people point to the fact that the unborn is dependent upon the mother for its survival, at least for the first 20 to 25 weeks of its development. But why does dependency upon another person somehow disqualify you from being valuable? I mean, there's many people who are dependent upon dialysis machines, insulin, and other kinds of hospital equipment for their survival that disqualify them from being valuable. There's some elderly people that are dependent upon their grown children for their survival. Does that disqualify them from being valuable? Imagine if you were at a pool party, and you were the last person to leave the backyard and enter the house, and you saw a 1-year-old kid fall in the deep end of a pool. Now, that child's life is entirely dependent upon you for their survival. Would you be like, well, because you're dependent upon me for your survival, you are not valuable, you're not a person? That's nonsense. Because being dependent upon somebody else doesn't disqualify you from being valuable. And so that's why degree of dependency is also irrelevant. And so what you have here is that abortion turns out to be a form of discrimination, right? I mean, history is crowded, as you were alluding to, sir, of many examples in which there is a class of human beings that is disqualified from being valuable simply based on some arbitrary characteristic. And so, for example, African Americans were discriminated against in our own country. They were a class of human beings, right? Class of human beings who were disqualified from being valuable based on an arbitrary characteristic. What characteristic? Their skin color. Why? Well, so they could be enslaved and used in forced labor or whatever. Discrimination against Jews also happened in our world history. They were also a class of human beings that was disqualified from being valuable simply based on an arbitrary characteristic. What characteristic? Ethnicity. Why? So they could be, you know, experimented on, exterminated. And today, unborn children are also a class of human beings that is being disqualified from being valuable based on, again, arbitrary characteristics. They're too small, they're not developed enough, they're in the wrong location, or they're too dependent upon their mothers. Why? So they can be killed, and so that their mothers, according to Planned Parenthood, can get their education completed, fulfill their career, because they can't afford it, because they're done having, you know, children, or yeah, they're done having children. Which, by the way, according to Planned Parenthood's own statistics, are 90% of all abortions that are occurring. The other 5% are other socioeconomic reasons. But notice that at the end of the day, that's what abortion is. It's a form of discrimination against a certain class of human beings. And so our view, the pro-life view, is contrary to discrimination. We are an inclusive view. And our view is this. No human being, regardless of size, level of development, race, gender, or place of residence, should be excluded from the community of human persons. Our view of humanity is inclusive, wide open to all, especially to those who are small, vulnerable, and defenseless. And so notice, I use this language because it's the kind of the language of our culture. Inclusion, acceptance, you know. And so that's really what our view is. It's all the things that our culture puts a premium on, you know. Don't discriminate, be inclusive of all. Well, we are. We're the ones who are the inclusive ones. So that's the third task, is to show that all human beings are valuable. And again, usually when they say the unborn might be a human, but it's not a person, they're going to do it based on disqualifying certain humans based on arbitrary characteristics. So, any questions? Okay. Yes,
I still
Kim.
I want to know your opinion.
Yes, good. Thank you for reminding me that. Okay, so the question is what about the case of a woman's health, a mother's health is in danger? So, for example, a common example of this, and I have friends who've had this, is an ectopic pregnancy. Now, an ectopic pregnancy is one where the unborn child is growing and developing in some place other than where it's supposed to, like the endometrial lining. So it could be in the fallopian tubes. So these are the tubes between the ovary and the uterus. Or it could be in the abdominal wall. You know, sometimes even you have, you know, unborn humans growing in that area. And so if you leave the pregnancy to continue, this will eventually cause the mother potentially to die. And there's a very good chance that she would die from this kind of a thing unless you take action. And so the question is, well, what do we do in this situation? Now, here's my view, and I'll explain the rationale for my view, and then we can see if there's any disagreement about it. But here's my view. In this instance, we face what's called a moral dilemma. And a moral dilemma is not just a tough situation. A moral dilemma is when we have two potential actions, both of which have a positive and a negative outcome. And so you got to decide which is sort of the greater good or which is the lesser evil. And so in the case of an ectopic pregnancy, I would argue that it would be permissible in that case to take the life of the unborn child to save the life of the mother. And here's why. In my view, it's better that one should live, the mother, than two should die, both mother and child. In the case of an ectopic pregnancy, the unborn child is going to die no matter what. We don't currently have the technology to extract the unborn child and then place them in the endometrial lining where the child can then develop normally. And so as a result, the child's going to die no matter what. If we do nothing, both mother and child will die. And so it would be a greater good to allow one to survive than to have two both die, both mother and child. And this is why I call it a moral dilemma. Because if you do nothing, both die. If you act to take the life of one, that is still a undesirable, you don't want that. You don't want to kill anybody. But if it's to save the life of at least one rather than allowing two to die, then I would argue that it would be the greater good or the lesser of two evils. So to give an analogy, which doesn't work in every case, but if you're on like a cruise ship and there's a person drowning on one side of the ship and then on the other side of the ship, but you only had one life preserver, if you don't throw it out to either person, then they'll both drown. But you could act to save the life of one by throwing it out to one of them, at least save the life of one. So, I mean, that's kind of the situation that I'd be thinking about. But this is how I would answer the moral dilemma. So, in my view, this is not elective abortion. It's abortion done in the case of a medical emergency. And these were done, by the way, even prior to Roe versus Wade. And I would argue that this would be the one kind of exception that's allowed. But notice, it wouldn't make our pro-life view inconsistent. Because maybe people say, well, isn't that inconsistent? No, it's not inconsistent because we're treating both the mother and child as full human beings, both deserving of protection. But just like in any kind of a moral dilemma, where you can only save one, you have to do something. If we don't do anything, they're both dead. How good is that? You know, it's not good. So that would be my rationale on that question. Any other comments or questions before we take a break? Concerns, disagreements? I just laid a moral dilemma bomb on you. Okay, well, then let's go ahead and take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about how this logic and these arguments and tactics can be applied to stem cell research and cloning in the realm of bioethics. Okay?